It's the Pete Callender Show. With more than 20 years as a reporter and radio host in North Carolina, Pete Callender is helping solve the world's problems one podcast at a time. Because he's a giver. And now, here's Pete.
What's going on? What's happening? Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. The show is made possible by patrons like Grant, Ashley, Sarah and Barry, Patrick, Shan, Joseph, Dan, Brian, John, Robbie, and Janet. Thanks so much for becoming patrons of the program. You can become a patron as well. Just simply go to thepetecallenershow.com and you click on the link up at the top, and that gets you access to exclusive content as well as some of the world-famous bumper stickers. I can say world-famous because... No, it's true. I can say world-famous because there are... obvious IP addresses that show up in my analytics, and they're from all over the world. I mean, yes, they could be VPNs, but I'm going to say world famous, if that's okay by you. All right. So what do we got? Oh, today's show also presented by General Equipment Rental. For three generations, family-owned and operated, General Equipment Rental in Weaverville has been providing people with the tools necessary that they need to finish the projects they're working on. Whether you are a general contractor or you are just doing some home improvement stuff around the house, then you need to know General Equipment Rental, generalrents.com, because no matter what the project is, having the right tool makes it go so much easier, and you'll make so many fewer mistakes. You'll make fewer mistakes. You will, because when you're trying to use the wrong tool to do something, just problems arise. It just doesn't work out. Trust me, I renovated a house with improper tools. It took me twice as long and cost me twice as much. So get the right tools, go to General Equipment Rental, and they'll show you how to use the tools, whether it's an earth mover or it's some power drill, okay? They can show you how to use it, and so you're comfortable using it. You take it home, you take it to the job site, you use it, and then you bring it back. It's a fantastic business model, and it really helps people. I wish I had General Equipment Rental at the house I was renovating, but it was in Charlotte. So that was a bit of a drive, so I wasn't going to go all the way to Weaverville to get this stuff. But I will now, for my next house, any project that I'm looking to do. I think I might be doing some tile work at some point, and I'll be renting a tile saw from General Equipment Rental. GeneralRents.com is the website. They are also your official licensed Husqvarna and Honda outdoor power equipment sales and service provider. So go to GeneralRents.com and think outside your toolbox. Alrighty, so it has been called the 26 words that created the internet. Section 230 of the 1996 Communications Decency Act, it's a landmark U.S. law that shields social media companies like Twitter and Facebook from liability for content that their users post. The 26 words are, no provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. Okay? No provider of the service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of somebody else on that platform. Okay? Those are the 26 words that created the internet, so-called. 47 U.S. Code, Statute 230, Section 230, I should say. And it's been called the law that created the internet, and it accomplished this through a simple premise. You are responsible for what you say or do online, and the platform that hosts your content is not. Okay, so recently, President Trump said he would veto the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the bill that allocates military funds every year, if the NDAA did not terminate Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. This has become a very hot topic among conservatives in recent years because of the censorship that these platforms are engaging in against conservative users. Joining me now is Jeff Westling. He is the Technology and Innovation Policy Fellow at the R Street Institute. You can read his work at rstreet.org. Welcome to the show, Jeff. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. So We're talking about Section 230, and this is what technically, and I have it here someplace, what it comes from the Telecommunications Act of 1996, 47 U.S. Code 230, Section 230, and this has gotten a lot of attention in the Trump era. So first, tell us, what is Section 230 before we start going into why people are, you know, mad about it and what it actually does, but what is the rule?
Sure. So Section 230 basically just says that the interactive computer services, so your Facebooks, your Twitters, they are not going to be held as the publisher or the speaker of what the users post. So basically, the reason this law even exists is that, you know, we had platforms back in the 90s that were starting to moderate content. Some weren't. Some were. So the courts had determined that if you start moderating any of the user content, you're going to have the requisite knowledge for everything on the site, and therefore you can be liable for everything on the site. Basically, what that means, that is, if I moderate user content and I leave something up and it's defamatory, the person who's defamed can actually sue me. But here's the thing, if you don't moderate at all, you don't have the knowledge of any of the content, and they can't sue you as the platform. So that left this kind of bad incentive for companies not to take down harmful or, you know, mean content that they wouldn't want on their site because they're afraid of liability. Section 230 comes in because it wants to get rid of that dilemma. It's going to say, go ahead and moderate any of your moderation efforts. That's not going to make you all of a sudden the publisher or speaker of what your users post. So it's just there to make sure that people can't go after Facebook or Google for their moderation decisions.
Not that Facebook or Google were around back then, right? I got a chuckle when I was looking at who the original lawsuits were over.
It was CompuServe,
yeah, and Prodigy, I think, was the other one. Yeah. And so obviously nobody really, well, few people, I guess, envisioned what we would have right now. But that's what 230 was designed to do. So what is it not? I don't know if this is even a proper question, but you've said what it is. What is it not?
I think that's actually a really good question, because we've heard a lot of people say what this is when it's actually not what they're saying what it is. Number one, it's not a big handout to big tech. It's not something that's designed for, you know, huge tech platforms. This is specific about a type of content. It's when users post things online. So for your podcast, if you ever allow comments for users to come and say, oh, I really like your podcast today, if you give any room for users to come in, you benefit from 230. If I retweet somebody, I'm technically benefiting from 230, where the person can't come and sue me. And actually, the president used Section 230 to bend a lawsuit against him when he had retweeted something that was defamatory. So it's not like this handout to big tech. What it is, it's just there to make sure that any company that's going to allow users to speak online, they aren't going to be liable for what they say. The other thing is, it's not, I wouldn't say this isn't what it is, but another kind of fallacy that we've heard with Section 230 is that, well, if the platforms start acting too much like a publisher, they lose their Section 230 protections. No, that's not in the law. That's actually the exact opposite of the law. The law is designed for companies to come in and make some of these kind of more editorial-like decisions without being liable for them, because they want companies to go in and moderate in a way that is going to design the site that people want to use and takes down the harmful content and takes down the, you know, the illicit things that none of us want on there. And we just kind of determined that, you know, the platforms are probably in the best place to do this. Let's not make it so they are incentivized not to go after some of this content. So those would be the two main things. Number one, it's not a big handout. And number two, it's not something that, like, there's an arbitrary line, and if you go too far with your content moderation, you're now automatically a publisher. That's just not in the law, and I honestly don't know where that rumor even came from.
Mm-hmm. So let's take them one at a time then. A lot of people do believe that Section 230 protects big tech, right? And does so at the expense of the little guy. So if 230 were to go away, then theoretically, according to that line of thinking, right, then the big tech companies, they would be harmed and the little guy would be helped. Is that the case?
That's the exact opposite of the case, actually. So what basically the little guy right now is the startup that's coming in, and it's got, you know, two employees, four, five employees. There's no way, if they start getting a lot of users, that they can go through and moderate content, but they're benefiting from Section 230 as well. Who could theoretically, you know, handle the regulations and handle the increased lawsuits are the big companies. So what it's really designed for everybody in the ecosystem. And if we got rid of 230, I think what you would actually see is companies like Facebook, like Google, like Twitter, they would probably be fine. What they might end up doing is they might, over remove user generated content. So that means there's less speech online. But at the end of the day, they could handle some lawsuits. They can get past these, motions to dismiss phase and, get to discovery and not be, absolutely litigated out of existence. Who could get litigated out of existence is the startup that's trying to compete with them. And that's why when you saw, regulations like the GDPR in Europe, the privacy regulation that put a lot of burdens on some of these tech companies, Facebook was the one that actually got its market position entrenched. Like, it was able to sustain itself because it can handle the regulation. It's the little guys that are actually at most risk by just flat out removing Section 230 protections.
Which is, this story repeats itself in virtually all areas of the economy, right? From licensure laws. In North Carolina, we've got one where if you want to be a barber, you've got to go to, they make you go to classes and get your certificate. And it's like a multi-year thing, like just to cut hair. It's craziness.
Yeah.
And a lot of this stuff is put in place by the existing industry players in order to stiff arm new upstart competition.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that some of these big tech companies want to get rid of Section 230. They still are very much against it because it is going to be harmful to them. It is a protection for the big tech companies, too. It's a protection for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
But, we've seen when the fire hits under their feet a little bit, we've seen some of these companies that are like, that's fine, regulate us a little bit more. We want you guys to tell us how to do this because, we just don't like the public pressures against our moderation practices. And to me, that's the exact opposite of what we want. We want those public pressures against, the moderation practices, because that's going to drive kind of where the market should be and what, the standards we're going to hold the companies that we want to use to be. Like, that's a good thing. That's the market working. But yeah, no, and to your point about licenses, we've seen that all over the place. Shoshana, our digital media manager here at R Street, if you're interested in that topic at all, go look at her because she's fantastic.
I've been following her for years. I've interviewed her before years ago. Aside from her love of sloths, I'm she's fantastic. but this idea, though, that if we just got rid of 230, then things would somehow be better. It seems to me like getting rid of 230 forces, let's just say Facebook or Twitter, it forces them to take, as I see it, one of two routes, right? Like, they could either eliminate all user-generated content, which I don't know how you do that because their platforms are built on that very thing. Mm-hmm. So then the other course would just be no moderation whatsoever. Just take your just hands off, let everything fly. Are there other pathways?
No, I mean, those are really the two general pathways, but I don't think they need to not allow user-generated content at all. Companies like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, the companies with the resources, they could probably still allow user-generated content, but what they'd really have to do is crack down on anything remotely controversial. So they're going to be erring on the side of caution, and that just means that a lot of these posts that you see that are getting taken down now, there's going to be even more of that. And that's what, really frustrates me, coming kind of from the center right perspective, is that we've seen a lot of the conservative bias claims against Facebook. And, whether that's true or not, is up for debate. We haven't seen anything definitive, but there's been anecdotal cases of conservative speech that is treated differently than maybe some more left-leaning speech. But if you get rid of Section 230, a lot of that speech that you want to try to keep up is actually going to go down. So I don't know why the folks that want more content up think that removing Section 230 is the path forward that's going to get them to where they want to go. And again, this isn't something like Section 230 doesn't require you to keep content up, because these companies have First Amendment rights. They can take down anything they want to take down. And even if you take down or get rid of Section 230 tomorrow, nothing is going to really stop them from taking down content. And if unless they're afraid of liability, and they're going to take down everything, or maybe they'll just let everything up, but then no one wants to use that service anyway. And there's a lot of really bad forums online,
right?
Relatively easy to find. You can go find them, and they're not fun. I heard an example yesterday. Someone was saying, if you looked in your spam box on your email, that's a good idea of what these platforms could look like if they just get rid of moderation entirely. Anybody, I don't want that world.
Yeah, anybody who has run a website knows that one of the first things you need to do if you're going to allow comments on your blog or something is to put in some sort of a spam defender, because it's like as soon as you go live with that thing, somehow or another, the machines find you and they just start hammering you with these, you know, work from home, make $1 million a day sort of spam posts and such. All right, more with Jeff in a minute. First, let me tell you about Growers Hemp. I love talking about Growers Hemp because they offer quality CBD products for cheaper than you'll find, because they control the whole process from seed all the way to shelf. And these are North Carolina farmers, small family farmers that said, you know what, why don't we grow hemp, and why don't we control this process, and why don't we help people on their wellness journey so everybody succeeds all together? That's their business plan. That's the strategy. So I take CBD products. I take the oil. I take drops before I go to bed, and I sleep more deeply than I ever did prior to ever using CBD, because my brain kind of has a problem shutting down. It takes me a while. Like, I would lay in bed from, like, my entire life, I would lay in bed for usually half an hour to an hour before I could finally fall asleep. No longer. I take CBD drops and I fall asleep and I stay asleep and I wake up well rested, and I don't get that groggy feeling that sometimes, you know, you'll get if you, you know, take like a sleep aid, like an over-the-counter kind of a drug or something. And I don't get any of that. And by the way, that's what folks who participated in the focus group from the Pete Callender Show, they report the same results. So as with all CBD products, I got to give you the official GovCo disclaimer here. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration, and the efficacy of these products has not been confirmed by FDA-approved research. These products are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease, and nothing I have said is meant as a substitute for or alternative to information from your healthcare provider. Please consult your healthcare professional about potential interactions or other possible complications before using any product. Growers Hemp, by the way, if you go to their website, growershemp.com, and you use my name, Pete, you'll get 20% off. Growershemp.com. From North Carolina farmers to your home, Growers Hemp, it's about the hemp and not the hype. My guest is Jeff Westling. He is the Technology and Innovation Policy Fellow at the R Street Institute. I read that... This is actually from the Council on Foreign Relations, of all places. They say that providers or users of interactive computer services cannot be treated as publishers of, and thus held liable for, content produced by others. It also allows those companies to voluntarily take actions in good faith to moderate content. And I guess that's really the key here, right? When you talk about moderation of the content, it has to be done according to the Section 230, right? It's got to be good faith. And that's the rub. What is good faith? How do we define good faith moderation?
Well, there's a couple things there. Number one, it's actually kind of weird. The good faith is only in C2. So basically, there's two provisions in Section 230. Section 230 C1 is the provider of internet interactive computer services will be treated as the publisher or speaker, basically what we've been talking about. And the courts have interpreted that to mean basically exactly what you're saying. They have the right to take down whatever they want, and they're not going to be liable. Then C2 is in there as well, and it's kind of a little bit out of place, and this is the good faith provision. And what the courts have said is generally that the good faith is in their taking down content that they, you know, in good faith in terms of like their own terms of service, what they want to be on their website, that's going to be in good faith. So it's a really hard standard to like overcome to say that they're not operating good faith. And again, like I said, most of these like lawsuits come from C1, and that's why it's kind of weird that we've seen so much focus on this kind of good faith provision, because it's really not as relevant. For the good faith stuff, it's really important to understand the context of how this was passed. You mentioned at the beginning it was kind of part of the Telecom Act. It's really actually wonky how this law got passed. It was part of the Communications Decency Act, which was its own bill, which got incorporated into the Telecom Act. And basically the Communications Decency Act at the time was going to be pretty overbearing on all of these platforms. This provision was all about kind of a laissez-faire, you know, we're going to let the market kind of handle it. So they really were just trying to encourage platforms to moderate content. And the more you put restrictions on good faith, the less they're likely they're going to be to moderate that content, because they're afraid, well, what if this isn't in good faith? What if this is? And that's why C1 has been the main provision for the statute for as long as it's been. And it's also kind of why, and I don't want to diverge the conversation too far away from this, but I was going to basically the NTIA, as part of the executive order from the White House, they filed a petition for rulemaking at the FCC. Long story short, they're just trying to get the FCC to interpret some of these provisions like good faith. But the reason they're doing that is because they know that Section C1 is so clear and it's so ironclad in its language that the only way they can try to like get some weird interpretations of the law is to go after the provisions like good faith, because that's at least somewhat ambiguous. Like, you can at least have an agency come in and say, well, we're going to interpret what that means. But again, the courts don't really look at C2 all that often, and defendants never really use it because C1 is such a broad encompassing protection that, you know, it's something that's very easy for them to get at the very outset of the trial. So you don't have to worry about discovery fees. It's just, no, the law protects us for our moderation decisions. You can't hold us liable. But that's why we've seen, you know, some of the folks like the NTIA trying to muddy the water a little bit and say, no, this good faith provision actually applies in C1, and just really confuse the law when it's not designed that way. It's really just designed to encourage the moderation. And it's a little frustrating to see the language get misconstrued a little bit.
So, because I think when you talk about good faith, all you have to have is a terms of service that everybody has to agree to. And then you can change that whenever you want, and then you're covered, right?
Well, I mean, again, even the terms of service, you know, those aren't like binding promises,
sure,
right? They're just, you know, this is our general standards. We're going to make our decisions on a case by case basis, and we're going to, you know, do what we want to do as a platform. So that's why the good faith is really far encompassing, and most of the time it doesn't even come up. It's like I said, it's kind of a ladder provision that's not really all that relevant in the actual practice and application of the law.
What's interesting also is that Section 230 has come under fire, not just from the right, but also from the left a little bit. You got President-elect Joe Biden. He's actually called for the repeal of this section. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she calls it a gift to the big tech industry that should be taken away. One of the authors, right, Senator Ron Wyden, he has said that tech companies haven't done enough to get rid of what he calls slime online. And so it's not just the right that's got this thing in its crosshairs, right? So is that, I don't know, is that foreboding to you? Is that worrisome to you?
You know, it's funny. A lot of I've been talking about this all week and you know, for the last couple of weeks, and people keep thinking, oh, well, now that Trump lost, this is just going to go away. And it's like, no, this is not going away anytime soon. The fact of the matter is, you know, the content moderation practices of a lot of these companies, you know, they're letting a lot of bad stuff through, and it's not an easy job for them by any means, but it's definitely something that's in the crosshairs of Congress. And, you know, we've seen some bipartisan agreement on things, like the Earn It Act, which would theoretically, you know, remove Section 230 protections in specific cases if they don't. The law has changed a lot. I won't go too much into that, but the point being, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans have pretty much agreed that Section 230 is something that they could go after. And my worry is that they're not necessarily going after it in a way that's reasoned or well thought out. And especially the folks that say revoke it entirely, I don't think even, you know, strong critics of the law really want to remove it entirely, at least the experts. They tend to want changes where maybe there's like a reasonableness standard where you put only get your Section 230 protections if you take reasonable steps to remove content online or something. So that would have its own set of problems that we don't need to go into entirely. But that's, you know, that's an intellectual debate about where the bounds of Section 230 should be. When you remove it entirely, it takes away the incentive for moderating content. So that's why I don't understand their logic of just saying, let's remove this law entirely. That's just not a good approach, even if you want to remove content. But at the end of the day, I'm not as worried. When you hear, oh, Democrats and Republicans are going after the law, that must mean they're going to be able to do something. They want to go after it for very different reasons. And because of that, it's going to be hard for them to find common ground. The real issue is that Democrats want platforms to do more to take content down. They want them to take down some of the hate speech. They want to take down misinformation. Speaker Pelosi obviously had a fake video of her that spread. That I think the president actually spread it when it was just her slowed down. So it was speaking like, so it sounded a little bit slurred.
Yeah. I remember.
And Facebook, I believe, didn't take it down because, you know, they have their own policies. And so, you know, when that happened, that's obviously going to make the politicians on the left who you've seen some of this and say, hey, this isn't good. You should be taking this down. Why aren't you taking this down? Oh, you've got this protection. Let me go after that. Whereas the Republicans, obviously, they have their content taken down a lot more, or at least according to many of the politicians, they're having their content taken down at a higher rate and they want it to be left up. So it's going to be hard. I find it hard to imagine they're going to be able to find a ton of common ground on Section 230 that will address both of those concerns, because, you know, one side wants more content taken down, one side wants more content left up, and they're kind of speaking right past each other at times.
So they both want the same goal, but for different reasons, and so maybe that creates a logjam, and so nothing happens, essentially. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if there's some action, but it definitely, I don't think it'll be something like removing it entirely. I think it'll be something a little more targeted, or maybe they're using Section 230 as a threat and saying, hey, we want you to act this way. We can't force you to do it because of the First Amendment. But if you don't do this, you know, you're not going to get your Section 230 protections. And I mentioned EARN IT a little earlier. That's how EARN IT was originally structured. They had to really reframe the bill because they realized just how unconstitutional that is. So
whoops, it's a slight problem.
Oh, this thing called the Constitution keeps getting us in trouble. But you know, that's just something that we always need to be worried about. And not to go off on another tangent, but, you know, when we did the executive order, I wrote a piece for Lawfare blog that was kind of talking about the fact that changing the law isn't necessarily what the goal is here. It's changing the moderation practices. And if you're threatening them with removing this very important protection, you might be able to get some of these companies to make decisions more favorable to you, knowing that they don't want to deal with potential regulation. And that's really worrisome. That's, you know, government jawboning, private speech. And that's just something that I tend to really worry mm-hmm. about.
You mentioned also this reasonableness standard, which I remember hearing, I think it was the first time I heard it in court. I used to be a reporter and I would cover court cases. And I remember hearing the judge instruct the jury, about the reasonableness standard. And essentially it was like that a reasonable person would think. And it's like, so you're using the word to define the word, which doesn't help at all. Like, reasonableness just means, you know, the standard by which a reasonable person would judge something. Like, well, okay, everybody thinks they're reasonable, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And so that, I understand why that would present problems. But I think, like, the issue, particularly for folks on the right, is they see things that get taken down that don't deserve to be taken down. Or, I mean, the biggest example of this, and now just the other day, there's this big, you know, aha, we told you so kind of moment for the right with the New York Post story that got censored, right? Got taken down off of Twitter, mm-hmm. got taken down off of Facebook. It was about Hunter Biden and the laptop and Burisma and China and all this stuff. And now after the election, you know, a month goes by and all of a sudden, oh yeah, about that, story was actually true. And so when you've got the big tech firms, or I should say, you know, people working at these firms, and they're making calls about what is and isn't real or fake, and they haven't done research, right? They're just reading a news story and they're saying, mm-hmm. I don't believe that. I guess that's what they're saying. I want more sources. And so we're going to label it fake and then we're going to censor it. Like, that's the concerning part for a lot of folks on the right. And when you cross a line and you're calling people names and, you know, doxing them or threatening them, I think those are bright lines, right? But on something like this, like, I don't understand how that's defensible as an act of, you know, reasonable good faith moderation, so to speak.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of those stories where I think a lot of people, even in the Pro 230 camp, were kind of frustrated at the decision by some of these companies. I mean, I don't know the facts, so I won't comment whether it's the right or wrong decision to remove the post. But, you know, it's one of those things where the solution to this is being able to move to a different service. If you really don't like the way Facebook is doing something, there needs to be alternatives. And I think that there is. And I think that there's different ways that we can communicate online that you don't necessarily need to be using that site. And if you're threatening to leave and take your, I guess, eyeballs away, because that's what they really want. They want your eyes so they can sell you advertising.
Right.
If you leave that, then you can drive some of those moderation decisions. You know, you've got another app, Parler, that is, you know, kind of the conservative social media app now. They're, you know, talking about how important Section 230 is too, because that's an alternative. And, you know, if the president came out tomorrow
and said, look, Facebook is biased against conservatives. I'm not using it anymore. You shouldn't either. Everyone go to Parler. I think he could overcome a lot of those network effects that are kind of difficult for startups to break into, right? The reason everyone uses Facebook is because everyone uses Facebook. It's almost like a self-defeating prophecy, right? Where everyone's already on there, so it's hard to leave. But the more competition we have, I think that this problem becomes a less severe one, because now it's like, oh, I don't like the fact that they're doing this. I have alternatives. And I think that you know, highlighting when you think that they've made a bad decision is a good thing, and really holding them to task for decisions you don't like, that's good. That's the marketing, and I like that. But on that specific case, yeah, I mean, I know some people who are upset that the people that some of these platforms took it down, and they're still big pro 230 advocates because they understand the importance of the law.
All right, more with Jeff in a minute. First, if you are thinking about buying or selling a house, then the only real estate agent that you need to know and call is My Real Estate Agent. And I'm not just saying that because she's my real estate agent. I'm saying that because she'll get your house sold fast and for more money. There are listeners of the program that have used Rowena Patton and her all-star powerhouse team, and the house sold like almost too fast. This is why I say when you call her, start packing, because it happens that quickly. She gets buzz around your house. People swoop in and they're like, gimme, 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 and your house sells. Okay. Well, I mean, I don't know if they're all saying gimme, 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 but it's kind of like that. And all you do is give her a call and then be ready. 333-4483. That's the phone number. 333-4483. Her website is mountainhomehunt.com. She has buyers already lined up. Now, if you're thinking about buying a house, she's got homes at all price points. Christy and I are using her and her team to buy our house. You should too. Give her a call. 333-4483. Rowena Patton and her all-star powerhouse team. Look them up online at mountainhomehunt.com and then start packing. Jeff Westling is my guest. He is the Technology and Innovation Policy Fellow at the R Street Institute. Website is rstreet.org. What is the status of, you mentioned Trump's executive order, what is the status of that? This was what done in May, and it's on preventing online censorship. And so is that, do you expect that to get repealed when Biden goes into office, or does this thing have any kind of legs beyond a Trump presidency?
Oh, so this is a great question. So basically what the executive order did was it had the NTIA, one of the executive agencies, petition the FCC to initiate a rulemaking. So basically nothing's really happened yet on the executive order. We're waiting to see what the FCC is going to do. Rulemaking process, basically they need to issue a notice of proposed rulemaking before they can issue any final rules so that the public has a chance to comment. And with the Republicans obviously losing the election, or I guess not obviously, but with it looking like the Democrats are going to be taking over the FCC going into the new year, it's very unlikely that the Democrats are going to move on any kind of NPRM or any final order of rules relating to the executive order. But that doesn't mean that they can't do anything. And there's been a little bit of chatter over the last couple of days, even just the last couple of days, that maybe what they're going to do is a declaratory ruling. And this is a very different thing than kind of formal rules that are binding in a court of law. These would be, you know, the agency's interpretation. And unfortunately for the agency, it doesn't actually enforce any of Section 230, right? It has nothing to do with the FCC, and they can't come in and you know, enforce its authority on online platforms for how they're moderating. But they could make some interpretations and just say to the courts, hey, this is how we see the law. And it would be a persuasive authority where it wouldn't actually force courts to do anything, but they would be able to look at it and say, well, we're going to maybe, you know, view it a little bit differently in this particular case. And I don't necessarily think that'll have a big impact in any kind of future litigation. But what it could have is some impact on just the general discourse about Section 230. And it could keep this conversation going a little bit more. Like I said, I don't think any final rules are going to come out of this just because of the nature of the timing and the fact that we're probably going to have a Democratic FCC taking over pretty soon. But that's not to say that they can't do anything. And the declaratory ruling would just be the one avenue kind of forward.
Gotcha. Is there anything else on this that you want to add that you think is important or interesting to note that we haven't already covered?
I mean, we've covered a lot. I think just to remember why the law exists. And, you know, whenever I think my big advice to people contemplating changes to Section 230 is always, why does the law exist? And how would your proposal actually benefit, you know, the moderation ecosystem, right? Would it do more than good? And I always look at kind of that dilemma, that initial dilemma that we talked about. is this going to reimpose that? Is it going to make it less likely for platforms to moderate bad stuff? Or is it going to make it less likely that they're going to allow user content at all? And if you're, you know, contemplating that as you're thinking about changes, at least, you know, those harms will be considered. And that's really important.
Yeah. Jeff Wessling, Technology and Innovation Policy Fellow at the R Street Institute. Thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, the Senate recently confirmed the appointment of Nathan Symington or Symington to the FCC. The vote was entirely on party lines after Democrats objected to the nomination. This is a story at TechCrunch.com written by Devin Koldewey. And I'm going to go out on a limb and say I kind of detect a little bit of a left wing leaning here, just a tad. But Symington, he writes, has been a senior advisor at the Commerce Department's National Telecommunications and Information Administration, where recently he helped craft the public relations effort around Donald Trump's attacks on Section 230, the law that prevents companies like Twitter and Amazon from being liable for things posted on them by users. The rush to confirm a new commissioner follows the unceremonious dumping of Mike O'Reilly, a Republican commissioner who has generally fallen in line with this administration's policies, but made the fatal error of speaking out against the effort to change Section 230. Due to be nominated for another term, he was instead dropped in favor of Symington, who has demonstrated no scruple about using the FCC as a muzzle for social media. The FCC is balanced 3-2 in favor of the administration's party, but is technically independent. Control of the Senate, though, and that's going to be determined by this runoff in Georgia, control of the Senate is going to determine whether or not we have a 3-2 Democrat majority on the FCC, or does it remain 2-2? Because there's an opportunity here for the Republicans to obstruct the FCC's work because they rushed through a single nomination and confirmation that established a 2-2 tie that could be maintained by declining to confirm any nomination by the Biden administration. Now, first off, I think it's hilarious that they say the Republicans would be obstructing the FCC's work as if they're just simply going about work and Republicans are going to be like, no, you can't do that. No, you can't do that. No, you can't do that either. Could it be that Republicans might obstruct Democrats on things with which they disagree with Democrats, right? Like maybe that would be the obstruction. And of course, if Democrats were trying to obstruct Republicans, it would be just resistance, you know, hashtag resist. In such a situation where if it's a 2-2 tie on the FCC, it would essentially be frozen. Without a majority, neither side would be able to pass rules and regulations. No. Since it's nearly certain that the opposing two commissioners would vote against them. It's actually not nearly certain. It's just it's going to depend on what the rules are. And, you know, if you want to go uber regulatory, then, yeah, probably Republicans are not going to go along with that. While some work could occur at the bureau level and ordinary business like collecting fees or and so on could happen, there would be no big moves like reestablishing net neutrality. There you go. That's what it's about. This is what they're looking at. They're hoping for a restoration of net neutrality. That's what they want to see happen, which is weird because I thought we were all dead from when net neutrality got repealed. Yeah, but apparently those of us who survived net neutrality and have not been killed by COVID, then we are going to die again, I think. I'm not really sure. But yeah, like that was the... that was the narrative back then. I'm old enough to remember how people were trying to scare everybody into going along with this net neutrality. And they said, we're going to have to pay for all the internet. Remember that? We're going to have to pay for it, not the internet, but social media posts. You're going to have to pay $5 if you want to post something on Facebook. That's what the end of net neutrality means. Yeah, no, it never happened for some reason. Isn't that amazing? That's what they're concerned about. They want to try and make sure that they get three Democrats on that FCC so they can put net neutrality back in place. I'm not a fan. Now, I am a fan of old Grouch's military surplus. Okay. And winter is here. Cold weather is here. And if you are realizing that, you know, that jacket you've been wearing for years and years while you go out hunting, it's just not doing the job anymore. Maybe all the sweat and grime has probably made the jacket not as insulated as it once was. They do get thinner over time. Have you ever noticed that? They get kind of flattened out. Anyway, go to Old Grouch's Military Surplus. He has all the cold weather gear and clothing, wool sweaters, military field jackets, woolen fleece, toboggan, socks, Gore-Tex jackets, heavy-duty warm clothing for a lot cheaper than you're going to find at most outdoor stores. Go to Old Grouch's Military Surplus. It's on Main Street in downtown Clyde. Shop is open Monday through Saturday. It's across the street from the anti-aircraft gun, and 24/7 open at oldgrouch.com. So what else might we see in a Biden administration? Well, Joe Biden vowed to undo the Title IX reforms. What are the Title IX reforms? Well, I'm glad you asked. Let's get into it. Last May, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos formally issued new rules regarding Title IX, the law that prohibits sexual harassment in schools. Though intended to clarify confusing and contradictory past federal guidance that had weakened due to process protections for students that got accused of misconduct, the new rules drew swift condemnation from Democrats who accused the Trump administration of harming sexual assault survivors. And Joe Biden vowed to put a quick end to these reforms. This is Bobby Soev in Reason.com at the website Reason.com. He is a senior editor at Reason. And he points out, though, that this is not going to be so easy for Joe Biden, who wants to put a quick end to these reforms, because they're going to have to go through the whole process because Betsy DeVos did. See, but Betsy DeVos went through a multi-year review as required by the Administrative Procedures Act. Going back to the previous Title IX standards, where you could just accuse somebody and ruin their life, those standards that the Obama administration promulgated. So if you want to go back to that, it's going to require an equally involved and time-consuming process. Biden officials now could signal to colleges and universities that, you know, the Biden folks, like the administration, is just going to ignore violations of the new Title IX rules. So, look, if you want to railroad some people, we're totally not going to care. Like, the Biden administration could send that signal with a wink and a nod kind of deal, right? But here's the problem. That would not prevent those students that you railroaded from suing your butts into oblivion, colleges. Okay, because if you don't fail to or if you fail to follow the protocols and the procedures that Betsy DeVos's agency put in place, those protections, right? If you fail to follow those, then the student that got railroaded, they can sue the school. So I'm not sure that a lot of colleges are going to be chomping at the bit to follow old Joe's recommendation there, the wink and the nod deal. That's not going to protect them in court. Anything short of new legislation, which could be blocked by a Republican-controlled Senate, which, again, assuming that the Republicans win both of those runoff races in Georgia, like, this is how important that Georgia race is. It's likely to create mass confusion about which rules need to be followed, even as some courts have reached the conclusion that it is indeed mandatory for education officials to provide due process rights to accused students. This is one of the things that I do not understand this. If a student is accused of committing a crime against another student, the university is not the organization or the institution that should be in charge of investigating and prosecuting anybody for anything. Sorry, you guys are just, you're academics, okay? I don't mean that like as a pejorative. I'm not trying to like denigrate people. I'm just saying this is not your wheelhouse. You are not investigators. Okay, you're not lawyers. I guess maybe if it's a law school, then maybe that would be okay. But you're not lawyers, right? You're not judges. You don't know all of the laws. You don't get to run these kangaroo courts on your college campus because you're under this notion that this is our own little utopian version of society right here in the ivory tower halls. Like, no, if you accuse somebody of a crime, then police get involved, prosecutors get involved. That's how that should work. And universities have been doing end runs around the criminal justice system for a very long time. I've never liked it. I didn't like it when the Catholic Church was doing it. I darn sure don't like it when colleges do it. So Title IX has been around for decades. It's a federal statute, and it obligates schools that get federal funding to protect students from sexual misconduct. Okay, fine. During the Obama administration, the Education Department's Office for Civil Rights vastly expanded the purview of Title IX, advising colleges and universities that their money is going to be at risk if they did not make more aggressive efforts to investigate harassment and assault, right? So much like many things helped corrode the trust and credibility of our institutions, they trace back to the Obama administration. The office's written guidance encouraged education officials to move towards a single investigator model, which this model meant that if you had a misconduct claim, that it was handled by a lone administrator rather than a panel. So this, I mean, think about that. The federal government is telling schools how to investigate, and their idea is don't do a panel, do one. Do one person, one investigator. That's all you need. The guidance also then discouraged cross-examination of alleged victims by accused students. So you don't get to face your accuser. You don't get to question them. You don't get to impeach their credibility. Right? So if you have somebody making a false allegation, oh, well, you're screwed. All they have to do is convince the one investigator. What else? It chipped away at due process. As a result, hundreds of students brought lawsuits against their universities for following guidance that they claimed violated their rights. Okay, so again, this is at Reason.com. Under the Trump administration, Betsy DeVos made it a priority to fix this mess. Since the Obama era guidance was just that, guidance, rather than a formal rule, DeVos was able to rescind it without much difficulty. But forcing colleges and universities to stop following that bad guidance, well, that was a little bit more difficult, okay? So yeah, so how do you fix that? Well, that means you got to go through this really lengthy process. They have to propose new rules. They then do a public notice period, which is really long. They do a comment period. It took them almost 2 years for the rules to get worked up and then put into effect. And they were put into effect in August 2020. The rules, which require a kind of cross-examination by representatives for the accused, it abolishes the single investigator model, and it limits the scope of Title IX. These changes now cannot be undone unless the government goes through the public notice and comment period all over again. And so I'm not so sure that the Democrats are going to be willing to invest that kind of time and energy. Maybe they will. They didn't last time, right? And if the Republicans hold the Senate, I'm pretty sure they're not going to do it now. But who knows? If they get control over the House and the Senate and the White House, they may just ram through a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, we're going to have to see. We're going to have to see what happens in Georgia. Yeah, it's very concerning. If your mattress is concerning to you because, you know, it's got like these big sagging areas, these big pits that you just roll into when you get into the bed. Here's one. How about the edge of the bed where you sit to tie your shoes or you get in and out of bed every day? And there's like that sag right there on the edge of the bed. You need a new mattress. OK, go to Mattress Man. I went to Mattress Man, got my mattress from them years ago. Christy and I love it. King size memory foam. I've talked about it. You know, it's like sleeping on a marshmallow. But maybe you don't want a memory foam. Maybe you want an inner spring, the traditional inner spring mattress. They can help you. The sleep consultants at Mattress Man can help you find the right mattress for you. They have a 120-day comfort guarantee, and they have 5-star local delivery service. Now, they do ship nationwide. They have 4 stores in Asheville, Arden, and Hendersonville, and they have the Biltmore collection. This is made by Restonic in Fayetteville, and these are the mattresses that are in the hotel and in the inn that are located on the Biltmore Estate grounds. So if you want awesome mattresses for great prices, go to mattressmanstores.com or go to any of their 4 locations and experience the difference for yourself. Mattressmanstores.com. Buy local and sleep better. All right, what else might the Biden administration do? How about a gun tax? Could top $34 billion. American gun owners could face tens of billions of dollars in new taxes to keep the guns they already own under Democrat Joe Biden's gun ban and tax plan. This is a piece at the Washington Free Beacon by Stephen Gutowski. He says at least 20 million rifles and 150 million ammunition magazines would be caught up in the sales ban and registration scheme that Biden touted on the campaign trail. That according to a National Shooting Sports Foundation report. The new taxes would cost Americans more than $34 billion, according to a Washington Free Beacon analysis. I was actually at a friend's house the other day, and he showed me his phone. He had the screenshot on his phone of the price of a box of ammo. I believe it was 9mm for it was 100 rounds for $120. That's over $1 a round. Who can afford target practice at these prices? Biden wants to ban new sales of AR-15s and similar firearms, as well as any ammunition magazine holding more than 10 rounds, sizes that come standard on most modern rifles and handguns. He would pay some owners to surrender the affected guns they legally own and force everybody else to register their guns under the National Firearms Act. That proposal would require owners to pay a $200 tax stamp for each item. This won't happen. I'm just saying this is not going to happen. Do you think you're going to be able to get gun owners to register their firearms with you? How does that work? This is the thing that always gets me. How exactly do you expect this to work, especially after you've defunded the police departments? Right? You're going to send cops out to go collect weapons from people to confiscate them if they don't sign up on the registry? That's first off. Like, second of all, like, how do you even know who's got the guns? Because I lost every one that I had. I know I lost every single gun that I own. I was in the woods, I tripped and I fell, and I was carrying every gun that I own, and they went in all different directions. There were a lot of leaves on the ground. It was cold. I had to go to the bathroom, so I was like, I can't stick around. And so I left, and I went back and I looked for them. I could never find them again. So it's a very similar story, by the way, that I've heard from other people. Like, virtually every single gun owner that I know, they've all lost their guns too. So I'm not exactly sure how you're going to be able to get people to voluntarily put their names on a list for GovCo, I know people who aren't gun people, they don't really appreciate this, but people who are gun people, they know what happens to the list of gun owners because history has shown us what happens. Initially, and I know this is sort of Godwin's law, here I go, I'm going to say it, Godwin's law is that as soon as you mention Hitler or the Nazis, then the argument is over. This is a social media, group chat room kind of rule, right? As soon as somebody says it, you know the argument's over. However, this actually did occur when the government in Germany was very concerned about people owning weapons. And so they said, give us all of the names of all of the gun owners because we don't want radicals to have guns. And then what happened was that the radicals won the election and then they took over the government and they got control of the lists. And now they knew who had the guns. And then they went after the guns. And once they disarmed the population, that population becomes way easier to control. Now, if you were not aware of that story, now you are, but probably you're not in the Second Amendment world, because everybody in the Second Amendment world, they know that story. They know this history, keenly aware of it. So I don't understand how Biden and his Democratic advisors, how they think this is going to go and why they think that people who know that story, keenly aware of it, why these folks would voluntarily put their names on lists and sign their guns away, do gun buybacks. By the way, who does the gun buyback programs is usually people who come across like really old guns. they know they're worthless, so they sell them to GovCo. Yeah, so I don't know why they think this is going to work. I would submit it's going to end badly. It will be done poorly, not good results. But we shall see. Like all things with the Biden administration, we're going to find out. All right, that's a wrap for this episode. Thanks for listening. I appreciate it. Remember, please subscribe to the podcast and give it a positive review. Go to thepetecallinershow.com, get all the links. Thanks for listening. Talk with you later. Don't break anything while I'm gone.